Out front next, graphic, never before seen police body cam video of George Floyd's arrest shown in court. Floyd pleading with officers not to shoot him, seen struggling to breathe. Plus, President Biden today unveiling part of his $4 trillion infrastructure plan, calling it a once-in-a-generation investment. Well, it's a lot more than that. And does he have the votes to pass it? His labor secretary is my guest. And Pfizer says its vaccine is 100% effective in kids aged 12 to 15. And tonight, our Dr. Sanjay Gupta has an exclusive look inside Pfizer's vaccine labs. Let's go out front. And good evening, I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, I can't breathe. The three-word rallying cry across the country and the world after George Floyd's death. Today, we heard it again and again, Floyd himself uttering those haunting words during former officer Derek Chauvin's trial. Some never-before body cam videos coming out today, revealing the moments that led up to Floyd's death. Now, the videos are disturbing and graphic because you keep hearing Floyd repeating that painful phrase, all too familiar phrase, as he's being arrested and placed into a police car.
I'm a black guy. Please, man. Leave it to me.
That was before Floyd was pinned down, which, as you know, he was then pinned down for nearly 10 minutes. So here's more of that video from one of the officers who was on Floyd along with Chauvin.
Okay, we
officer. They were talking, a lot of yelling.
Takes
a heck of a lot of oxygen. Come on, man.
I cannot breathe. They will kill me. I can't breathe.
It's really awful and hard to watch that, but the video goes on until you hear what appears to be an officer saying he can't find a pulse. Some of what you just saw was too much for one witness to see again, bystander who was standing just feet from Floyd on that day. Today, he broke down on the stand, and we're going to hear much more from him in just a moment. First, I want to go to Minneapolis Live, where Omar Jimenez is out front. He's been covering the trial. And Omar, another dramatic day in court, emotional testimony. And, you know, even if you saw it today, to watch that again every time, it is painful to watch that video.
Yeah, Erin, we've seen how emotional testimony can get in this trial, and today was no different. You add to that new video, context, and witness accounts, and you get a picture painted of what happened in the lead up to George Floyd having the police called on him and what happened after Floyd was loaded into the ambulance.
2 weeks ago.
Former officer Derek Chauvin heard for the first time since his murder trial began.
That's one person's opinion.
His voice audible on newly released police body camera footage as he defends his treatment of George Floyd to an onlooker.
Kind of control this guy because he's a sizable guy.
Yeah, it looks like he's probably on something.
The video shown during witness testimony may be the first and last time the court hears from the man charged with killing Floyd by kneeling on his neck if he doesn't testify.
Hands up right now.
New video dominated testimony Wednesday, including this police body camera footage showing the initial moments of George Floyd's arrest. Prosecutors also introduced this dramatic footage as George Floyd is pinned to the ground. But prosecutors began the day showing the events that led up to George Floyd's arrest. This surveillance video, made public for the first time today, shows Floyd in a black tank top walking through Cup Foods convenience store.
The truth and nothing but the truth.
19-year-old Christopher Martin was the cashier that day. He testified that Floyd was calm and friendly, but appeared to be high when he came in to buy a pack of cigarettes with a counterfeit $20 bill.
When I saw the bill, I noticed that it had a blue pigment to it, kind of how a $100 bill will have. and I found that odd, so I assumed that it was fake.
After telling his manager and trying unsuccessfully to bring Floyd back in the store, one of Martin's coworkers called the police. When asked to describe how he felt about what happened that day, the teenager said,
"Guilt."
Okay. Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
61-year-old Charles McMillan testified he saw police pin Floyd to the ground and tried to convince him to cooperate.
You can't win.
I'm not trying to win.
Pleading with Floyd as officers try to force him in the police car.
I was trying to get him to go.
So were you trying to just help him to...
make the situation easy?
Instead, the situation got worse. And seeing it again was overwhelming.
Mr. McMillan, do you need a minute?
I feel helpless.
And that feeling of helplessness is one that has been shared by so many of the witnesses that have testified so far, many of them young. That 19-year-old cashier was the fifth teenager or younger to testify as part of this trial in just the past few days alone. Court will be back tomorrow morning. We'll hear from a brand new witness. And we learned in a new court document just filed that the man who was in the car initially with George Floyd plans to plead the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination if he is called to testify. Aaron?
Omar, thank you very much. I want to go now to OutFront's legal team. They're going to be with us throughout the trial, Areva Martin and Ellie Honig. Appreciate both of you. And Areva, it is really hard to watch this footage, and you just keep hearing those same words again and again. It's so haunting, you know, as officers try to get Floyd into the police car, right, before he's even pinned down. He's screaming out. He's claustrophobic. He can't breathe. He calls for his mother. One bystander urging him to get in the car, saying, quote, "You can't win." What's your reaction to seeing all this? I mean, we really had never seen most of this before.
Yeah, Aaron, it was an emotional day for me as a lawyer, as a mother, you know, as an African-American woman. So I can only imagine what the jurors are going through as they watch this footage. And we thought, as, you know, civilians, that we had seen the totality of the horrific videotape involved in this case. And each day we're seeing new and new videotape that shows different angles, shows different perspectives. And each day the videotape seems to get more and more emotional. I think what was striking for me today on one of the videotapes from the police officers was Lane, former police officer Lane. In his first 15-second encounter with Mr. Floyd, he pulled a gun to his head and he dropped a series of F-bombs. So the inhumane way in which Mr. Floyd was treated didn't start with the 9-minute and 29-second videotape that we all have become so familiar with. It started with the very first interaction that the police officers on the scene had with Mr. Floyd. And I know that that had to resonate with jurors as they think about the reasonableness of the conduct involved with the officers.
So, Ellie, we also heard Chauvin's voice for the first time during the trial, which was an important moment. Again, in body cam footage, he was interacting with one of the bystanders after Floyd was taken away in an ambulance, right? So now we're talking about after the nearly 10-minute right time on his neck, right? Floyd's taken away in the ambulance, and then we hear Chauvin's voice for the first time. Here it is.
But I feel respect for you.
That's one person's opinion.
We gotta control this guy
because he's a sizable guy.
Yeah, and I tried to get in the car.
Looks like he's probably on something.
Very calm. He says, "You got to control this guy because he's a big guy. He looks like he's on something." Incredibly calm. Again, the context is this is after all of that screaming, the fighting, the begging for his life after he had his knee on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. How do you think the jury responded to that?
Yeah, Aaron, this is really powerful evidence. What the prosecution is doing here is taking the jury inside Derek Chauvin's mind. You have to remember the situation here. Derek Chauvin has just been on top of George Floyd for 9.5 minutes. George Floyd's body has just been taken away. And what jumped out to me, and I believe would jump out to the jury, is just how calm and bloodless and almost nonchalant Derek Chauvin is right after this happened. And if I'm arguing this case to the jury, I'm saying he is cold-blooded. You can see it. You can hear it right there. We lawyers use this term intent. Our viewers will hear this term intent throughout this trial. I would argue to a jury, this shows intent. This shows he did not care. He was barely moved. That shows what's in his head at the key moment.
And Areva, you hear Chauvin at that moment saying, well, he seems like he's on something. And the defense has focused on Floyd's drug use, right? They had it in their opening statement. We know that they're going to make that a crucial part of their defense, how it may have impacted Floyd's behavior. I want to play again what that employee said, that 19-year-old who was at the cash register, about his interactions with Floyd that day. This is what we heard today.
He seemed very friendly, approachable. He was talkative. He seemed to just be having an average Memorial Day, just living his life. But he did seem high.
So he said it. They knew he was going to say it. I mean, right, Areva? So prosecutors are owning that, right? They're making it clear. Look, we all know that there was something that shouldn't be. They're addressing it head on, though, right? That is strategic, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, Aaron. What lawyers tend to do, good lawyers in particular, is they know there's a weakness in their case. They want to be the first ones to introduce that weakness, to take the sting away from it. And what the prosecutors did really effectively with regards to Mr. Martin's testimony is allow George Floyd to be humanized, to show him as a person that was friendly, that was affable, that was engaging in discussion. And this notion that he died from a drug overdose or pre-existing heart condition doesn't fit with what we saw in terms of George Floyd, who was having interactions and conversations with that store clerk and appeared to be perfectly fine, not on his way to death, but for the knee on the neck for 9.5 minutes.
So, Ellie, the hearing today started with video that we had never seen before, as I said, a lot of it. But it started with Floyd inside the Cup Food store before all of this happened. So that's what Areva is talking about. And you do see him walking around the store, eventually comes to buy that pack of cigarettes with, you know, what turned out to be at the heart of all this, that counterfeit $20 bill. One of the witnesses, again, the cashier, put all of that into perspective. Let me just play the question and answer.
What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief and guilt.
Okay. Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
Obviously, he's talking about the time, you know, when you had the altercation with police and George Floyd's death. You know, this is another thing they're doing here, Ellie. They're clearly saying, putting in the counterfeit bill as a center of this, right? And we know the defense is going to try to say, well, look at George Floyd's rap sheet. Again, the prosecutors are going there first.
Yeah, the counterfeit bill in this whole thing should be a big so what. If I'm the prosecutor, I'm saying, so what? Who cares? Does that justify what came next? I think it was absolutely the right move strategically. Put it out there. Like Areva said, let the jury hear it from you, not on cross-examination. The bigger point here is that witness, Mr. Martin, express what so many witnesses have expressed, these lingering feelings of trauma, of hurt, and of regret and self-doubt. And that's natural. And I think the jury will really relate to that. And I think it will help the prosecution drive home the importance of this case to the jury.
All right. Thank you both very much. Areva and Ellie, obviously going to be with us, as I said, throughout this trial. And next, you know, we've been talking about the never-before-seen body cam footage from Officer Chauvin's camera itself. And we're going to have more of that new footage coming up. The former police chief from Detroit going to weigh in on what was caught on tape and what he thinks. Plus, President Biden's infrastructure plan. It's about infrastructure in a very broad sense, not just roads and bridges and airports and things. So what's in the multi-trillion-dollar package, and is it worth the stunning price tag? I'm going to talk to the Labor Secretary, Marty Walsh. And new details in the Justice Department's investigation into Matt Gaetz. Did the Republican congressman have a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl? Tonight, body camera video played in the Derek Chauvin trial showing one of the officers appearing to say he couldn't find a pulse on George Floyd almost 3 minutes before Chauvin released his knee from Floyd's neck. 3 minutes before. I warn you that some of the video that you're about to see you have not seen before, and it is disturbing.
Check his pulse.
Out front now, Isaiah McKinnon, the former police chief for Detroit. And Chief, I appreciate your time. So one of the officers, just the timeline again, I just want to bring this home to everyone. One of the officers says he cannot find a pulse on George Floyd. And yet, Derek Chauvin, the officers remain on Floyd's neck for almost 3 minutes after they're told they can't find a pulse. Is there any situation where that could be an appropriate use of force?
You know, Aaron, I've seen people die in Vietnam. I've watched them in the rebellion here in 1967 in Detroit. And throughout all my years in law enforcement, I've seen people die, but I've never watched someone die for almost 10 minutes. But this is just absolutely incredible to see. And when you see that the body cam and you hear the officers talking, you hear the other people talking to them, it's as if, okay, we're going to keep talking with you and tell you not to come here, but I'm going to keep my foot on this guy's neck. There was no rush for anything. It was just unbelievable.
So when we back this up to the beginning here, let's go back to the beginning of this tape. We're now seeing the officers' first interactions with Floyd. Okay, so this is their first interaction. So, you know, he's left the store. The counterfeit bill incident has happened. They approach his car, okay, because the store is called. They approach his car. Immediately, he's crying, saying he's been shot before. You see this gun of an officer being pointed at him, okay? They know this is over a counterfeit $20 bill. So this is how it begins, just so everyone understands how it begins. Things then escalate beyond this once they try to get him into the police car. I'll play that moment for you, Chief McKinnon.
Okay.
I can't breathe.
You know, you hear him. He can't breathe. He has anxiety. He's claustrophobic. Officers say that he's resisting in that video. As you look at it as a professional, do you see that? I mean, was this handled appropriately at any point, even at the beginning?
No, you know, Aaron, we're taught to de-escalate a situation. There's no rush on anything here. I mean, it's a $20 bill. We don't know if, in fact, George Floyd knew it was or was not. We don't know if he was high or what. But the thing here is, as law enforcement officers, we're taught to de-escalate, respect people. But what I saw there was a lack of humanizing a person. You know, we've seen officers throughout the years do those kinds of things with people. But take a step back. And some of the classes I taught at the university, I would say to the officers, do you want to be the lead story on the 5, 6, 11 o'clock news? Because if you do something like this, this is what's going to happen. Let's take a step back and let's see. Obviously, George Floyd was having a problem. So we as law enforcement officers, we should recognize that and make sure that we don't make the situation worse than it was when we got there. And that's exactly what they did.
Yeah, every step of the way. All right. Thank you very much, Chief McKinnon. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And next, President Biden going big with his massive new infrastructure plan.
The largest American jobs investment since World War II.
Can he get it through Congress? His labor secretary, who is just briefing senators, is here. And Congressman Matt Gaetz speaks out as we're getting new details about a stunning report that the Justice Department is investigating a possible relationship between the Republican and a 17-year-old child. Tonight, President Biden unveiling the first half of his up to $4 trillion infrastructure plan to help Americans recover from the pandemic. Biden saying it's worth every penny and will create millions of jobs.
Not a plan that tinkers around the edges. It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America. It's the largest American jobs investment since World War II. It's big, yes. It's bold, yes. And we can get it done.
The plan includes $621 billion to improve roads, bridges, tracks, $400 billion to enhance caregiving for older and disabled Americans, $300 billion on manufacturing, $100 billion to build or upgrade schools. Out front now, the U.S. Labor Secretary and former mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, he briefed senators today on the plan. And Secretary, I want to ask you about that, because what you did today is at the heart of all of this. There is no room for error in the Senate, given the 50-50 split. and not a single Republican backed Biden's COVID relief plan. So you've got to make sure every single Democrat is on board, especially the moderates who may balk at massive price tags like Senators Manchin and Sinema. So after your meeting today, do you feel like you have them all, that you're confident you can get a plan this size through?
Well, I think that, you know, you can't just focus on the Democrats. We got to focus on the Republicans and everyone in Congress. This proposed plan that the president unveiled today has a lot of great things for investment for Americans. And I think that every city and town all across this country benefits from something in the plan. And I think that, you know, I had conversations last night with some Republican senators and some Democratic senators, and everyone's open to the idea of having a conversation and seeing where we go from here. And I think that's something that's important. I think that, you know, going into just depending on one side at this point isn't the way to approach this bill. I know the president is focusing on all members of Congress, so they all have a chance to have conversations and have dialogues. And that's what I'm going to be doing. That's what a lot of the different people in the administration are going to be doing as well, is having very important conversations about the impacts of this plan on their constituencies and the American people.
Samir, the total cost of the package is expected to cost between $3 and $4 trillion. So from what we heard from President Biden today, he's made it clear he wants half of that paid for by corporate tax hikes. That would still leave up to $2 trillion currently unpaid for. I know Biden has said he's open, right? Give me some ideas. But context matters here, right? Just since the beginning of the pandemic, right? 1 year ago. So in 1 year, under Trump and Biden, America has increased our national debt by 27% in 1 year. We're talking about we're now up to $30 trillion. These numbers are so staggering, no one can even comprehend them. As mayor of Boston, you didn't get to do this kind of stuff. You had to balance a budget. You had to find money to pay for every single thing you were going to do at that time. Does all of this being sort of on borrowed terms keep you up at night?
President Biden has made it perfectly clear from the beginning of his presidency is that he intends on and tackling the debt as well. So it's something that we're not just adding to the bottom line. It's something that he's going to take a look at and we'll move forward at some point. But right now, the focus is on the American Jobs Plan, as it was the American Rescue Plan 2 weeks ago. The whole America has been dealing with a pandemic. People are out of work. 2 million women are out of work that aren't returning. They've been pushed out of their work, not returning to the workforce. We have an unemployment rate in the Black community of 9.2%, I believe it is. There's lots of challenges we have. And I think right now the focus needs to be on how do we get America working again? When we get America back to work again, then that's the right time in a couple of years from now to start thinking about how do we tackle the debt. I mean, I don't think the president's not just adding to the bottom line. He has a plan, and the plan is going to generate billions of dollars in return for the investments he's making now.
Okay, so look, we all need investments, especially in just, I mean, the basics that you're out there, right? The airports, the bridges, right? Bridges across this country are in danger of serious crisis. Like, I get that. But of course, Secretary, we all remember the big dig in your city of Boston. And as mayor, you benefited from that. I mean, that was incredible that it happened, right? There's all these roads running all over Boston. And then there's an 8-mile tunnel now under downtown. So your whole city was able to flourish. But construction started in 1991. It was supposed to finish in 1998. It took another nearly 10 years. It didn't finish till 2006. And the total cost was $15 billion, which sounds like nothing in the context of the numbers we're talking about here. But $15 billion, the point I'm making is it's three times what it was originally estimated to be. Do you think that the real cost of what you're putting out there is going to be similar?
No, I think it's going to be incumbent upon myself as Secretary of Labor and Secretary Buttigieg, as Secretary of Transportation, to make sure as we put this money out, that we spend this money right. This isn't our money. This is the taxpayers' money. This is the American people's money. And we need to make sure that the investments we're making are going to make a difference. The Central Lottery project that you're referring to in Boston, the benefit of that, we have a booming city, and I left a booming city with the exception of the pandemic. So federal investment can't spur economic development growth. And it has in the city of Boston, and it has throughout this country. And that's one of the important pieces to this bill, this plan, right now it's not a bill yet, is to kind of seed the growth that we need to happen coming out of a pandemic that has been damaging in so many ways to the American people.
You talk about 2 million women out of work, and the pandemic has hit female workers especially hard, right? There's a McKinsey study that I have just found stunning. It found that more than 1 in 4 women, many of them working moms, have been forced to either consider downshifting their career or leaving the workforce entirely. I mean, this is a stunning thing. This would set this country back generations in terms of women's participation in the workforce and fulfillment of their career aspirations. And now you've got a new report from the World Economic Forum that says it's going to take 60 years at least for women to reach equality with their male counterparts in terms of earnings here in the United States. And that's a lot longer than they had thought before. How do you even begin to fix this, these huge, big macro issues in the context of a bill like this?
First of all, we can't accept the findings in that report and settle saying that it's going to take us 60 years. We have to do a lot more work than that. In the Department of Labor, the Women's Bureau, I've already had these conversations on how do we create better pay equity, how do we create better opportunities, some of the training that we're going to have to be doing to get women back into the workforce. As mayor of the city of Boston, we saw this as a big problem, lack of childcare, lack of paid family leave. A lot of women did leave the workforce, and the women are a big part of our workforce here in the city of Boston, but in the country is huge. So we can't just settle and say, okay, this is what the report says. We have to do better. And I know that the Biden administration is definitely committed to doing better and moving quicker and moving faster. And I'm committed. And there's a lot of us in the administration, Vice President Harris as well. So this plan that we unveiled today addresses some of those challenges that we have in front of us. The CARES part of the plan, $400 billion investment, into children, into elderly, into people with disabilities. Different aspects of the plan help move our country forward and also help move women forward in a lot of different pieces of it.
Secretary Walsh, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And next, Congressman Matt Gaetz denying allegations related to sex trafficking of a minor. Tucker Carlson, though, does not seem to be buying the story.
I don't remember the woman you're speaking of or the context at all, honestly.
And our Sanjay Gupta takes us inside Pfizer's vaccine labs to show what they're doing to pump that vaccine out. And tonight, new details in the investigation into Congressman Matt Gaetz. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy weighing in on the news that the close Trump ally is being investigated for sex trafficking involving a minor. According to the New York Times, federal investigators are looking at whether Gaetz had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl.
I haven't been able to talk to Mr. Gaetz yet. Mr. Gaetz denies the story, but I look forward to talking to Mr. Gaetz. I haven't heard anything from the DOJ or others, but I will deal with it if any of it comes to be true.
Gaetz, as McCarthy said, denies the allegations. The FBI and the Department of Justice, both obviously involved here, are not commenting. Our new senior legal affairs correspondent, Paula Reed, is out front.
Tonight, news that the then Attorney General Bill Barr received multiple briefings while he was in office on the sex trafficking investigation into Representative Matt Gaetz. A source familiar with the matter tells CNN Barr did not take issue with the case, which began in the final months of the Trump administration. Another source tells CNN that Gaetz is being investigated over allegations of sex trafficking and prostitution, including involving a minor. Congressman Gaetz is denying the allegations after the New York Times reported he was under investigation for allegations involving a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old by the Justice Department.
It is a horrible allegation, and it is a lie.
The investigation is looking into whether the Florida Republican paid a 17-year-old to travel with him, according to the Times, a possible violation of sex trafficking laws.
That is verifiably false. People can look at my travel records and see that that is not the case.
A person briefed on the probe confirmed to CNN that federal authorities were investigating Gaetz as part of a broader probe into trafficking allegations against another Florida politician.
You know, providing for flights and hotel rooms for people that you're dating who are of legal age is not a crime.
According to Gaetz, the story is part of a $25 million extortion attempt against his family to make the DOJ investigation disappear. Gaetz said on Fox News they were supposed to wire a $4.5 million down payment today.
The Department of Justice were so concerned about this attempted extortion of a member of Congress that they asked my dad to wear a wire. I am demanding that the Department of Justice and the FBI release the audio recordings that were made under their supervision.
The Justice Department, though, has so far declined to comment. But according to a source familiar with the investigation, federal prosecutors are examining these allegations of extortion. It is separate from the ongoing investigation into Gates. The lawmaker alleges a former DOJ official is the one trying to extort him.
His name is David McGee.
McGee is a private attorney in Florida who left the Justice Department in the 90s. His law firm releasing a statement today. The allegation by the congressman is both false and defamatory. While he was with the DOJ, he would never have entertained a scheme such as what Congressman Gates suggests, nor would he today. Gates's interview with Tucker Carlson took a strange turn.
You and I went to dinner about 2 years ago. Your wife was there, and I brought a friend of mine. You'll remember her. And she was actually threatened by the FBI.
I don't remember the woman you're speaking of or the context at all, honestly.
Carlson distanced himself afterwards.
That was one of the weirdest interviews I've ever conducted.
Well, CNN has learned that Fox News host Tucker Carlson was livid that Gates appeared to be trying to rope him into a controversy involving the sex trafficking of minors. Now, CNN has also learned that Gates has approached at least one major criminal defense firm in the past few weeks as this investigation intensified. Aaron?
All right, Paul, thank you very much. And by the way, welcome to the network. Great to have you. And I want to go now to Katie Brenner, part of the team that broke this story for the New York Times, and Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler and sex crimes investigations expert. So, Jim, you know, just taking a step back here, how big of a deal is an investigation like this?
Well, if you're talking about sex crimes against children in general, federal sex crimes, or if you're talking about sex trafficking of children, those are both federal felonies. They're very serious charges.
So, Katie, a source tells CNN that then-attorney Bill Barr was briefed on the Gates investigation, and not just once, but multiple times while he was in office. And the source says Barr did not object to the investigation. He was briefed on it. He knew about it. Multiple times briefing, no objections. What does that tell you, Katie?
Well, that is correct. And what it tells us is that the allegations were really serious. It tells us the allegations seemed not only serious, but real. Attorney General Barr asked all of his U.S. attorneys last year, last February, in fact, to tell top officials, including the Office of the Attorney General and the Office of the Deputy Attorney General, whenever they were looking at a case involving somebody like a congressman, somebody like Matt Gaetz, because it would give officials an early look and basically would also give officials the ability to squash an investigation in its infancy if they did not think that it was valid. Instead, what happened in this case is when the facts were briefed up to the U.S. Attorney in the Central District of Florida, to officials at the Justice Department and to Bill Barr, they found the allegations to be credible enough to proceed. And to your point, not once, but multiple times they were briefed and multiple times they continued to say, yes, go ahead.
I mean, which is so significant. And Jim, you know, Gates says this is an extortion plot. He says a former DOJ official is trying to extort $25 million from him. He says his father has been wearing a wire, which, by the way, is not something you would say if that was actually going to accomplish anything or actually really, really happening at this point. I don't know why you would ever say and announce to the world that someone's wearing a wire. He told the Times he's not the subject, he's not the target of the investigation. That's what Gates is saying. Given everything that we now know, does that sound to be true to you?
Well, first of all, the other investigation, and it sounds like a completely separate investigation into any kind of extortion that he might be experiencing, has nothing to do with the fact that he was actually named as the subject of a criminal investigation. We don't have targets of those investigations. The DOJ sometimes will send out a target letter in certain white collar cases, but the FBI, when it investigates somebody who is the subject of the allegations, is called the subject of the investigation. So they are investigating him and his behavior, not somebody else.
Right, which is really significant. They're investigating him. And I also think you also just made a really significant point, which is whether he did this incredibly serious and awful thing, they're going to get the facts on that. That's separate from the extortion plot. Right? Both things could be true.
Absolutely.
Katie, on that front, what more are you learning about this alleged extortion plot?
So we know that Matt Gaetz' father, Don Gaetz, did in fact meet with people who they say were trying to extort the family. He met with them twice, and he wore a wire on both of those occasions. There are also at least two recorded phone calls with the men involved in this plot. He's named McGee. There are two others. One is a real estate developer who's had legal issues in the past. And what we know is that in those conversations, it sounds like the men danced around the idea of what could happen should the Gates family give money to help fund a very special project that everybody wanted to accomplish? And would that, you know, would it end in a pardon? Could it end in something else that'd be great for Matt? Would it end in something else that'd be great for the congressman's career? Nobody, to our knowledge, actually specifically made a quid pro quo statement saying, if you give us $25 million, we will do X, Y, and Z. But certainly Don Gates and people close to him have said that they believe these conversations to be blackmail, to be extortion, to be a way of saying we can make an investigation go away.
All right. Well, I appreciate both of your time very much. And again, the point stands, whatever happened in extortion, it could be completely separate from whether Matt Gaetz did what he is being investigated for doing or not. Thank you both very much. I appreciate it. And next, Sanjay Gupta going to take us inside Pfizer's vaccine labs' facility to see how they're pulling off what once was considered impossible, 13 million doses coming out of there a week. And President Biden's dog, Major, turning into a major pain for those in the White House. Tonight, new COVID cases up 25% over the past week. Now, that is the highest increase since mid-January. Deaths are up 6%. In New York City, there's a very troubling variant of concern that now composes more than half of all new cases. But all of this scary news comes as we're getting promising news from Pfizer, where clinical trials show that its vaccine is 100% effective in kids 12 to 15 years old, the main coronavirus. Our Dr. Sanjay Gupta is out front with an exclusive look at Pfizer's vaccine labs.
1 year ago, the process you are watching didn't even exist. And for Mike McDermott, Pfizer's president of global supply, a novel virus meant he needed a novel approach to vaccine manufacturing.
This has been an amazing 12 months, like nothing I've ever experienced in my career.
Remember, until the end of last year, no vaccine using mRNA technology had ever been authorized. And now I'm getting an exclusive look here in Kalamazoo, Michigan, at how Pfizer, in partnership with BioNTech, has produced millions of these vaccines.
60 million doses are surrounding us, hugging us right now. Imagine the impact that this room will have, just the doses sitting here today, on U.S. citizens and patients around the world.
Now that gives you goosebumps.
While Pfizer has more than doubled its output from a month ago, now producing at least 13 million doses a week, it's still not enough for McDermott.
By the middle of this year, we're at 13 million doses. We'll be at 25 million doses in a couple months.
So 100 million a month.
100 million a month.
And he's doing that by continuing to look for novel solutions, even seemingly simple ones. They found that their suppliers couldn't provide enough dry ice, so they decided to produce their own.
High-vis jackets so we can see each other, hard hat.
It also means that you are now seeing things that President Biden didn't see when he was here just 5 weeks ago in February.
So this is our new formulation suite.
Here is part of how they scale up so fast. These prefab formulation suites, they're all built in Texas before being brought here.
If we built it wall by wall on site, it would have taken us a year. By doing it modularly, we could cut that in half. If you want to get on one side, I'll get on the other.
And yes, as I found, it really is as easy as pushing it into place.
Man, that's amazing.
That is pretty smart.
But for McDermott, it really all came down to this key part of the process.
There's never been a commercial scale mRNA vaccine. So everything you see here is custom design.
Remember, what makes up Pfizer's vaccine is basically mRNA housed in four different lipids, which is really just fat. And this tiny tool, called an impingement jet mixer, makes it possible. Now, this is going to sound too simple, but here goes. On one side, mRNA is pumped in. On the other side, lipids. And they are forced together with around 400 pounds of pressure. Out comes a lipid nanoparticle, which McDermott says is the perfect package to deliver mRNA to your cells. That's the vaccine.
When you start to really scale it up like that, how confident were you that it was going to work?
So the first time somebody showed me this impingement jet mixer, I said, you can't be serious. How could you put billions of doses through here? So my confidence level was actually quite low. Not that it could be done. I knew it worked at this scale. But how could you multiply it?
Not only did McDermott crack that code and is now on his way to producing billions of doses for the world, his life has now come full circle.
Because as a kid, my dad worked for NASA. He was lucky enough to be in mission control in Houston when Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon, right? That amazing moment.
One giant leap for mankind.
And the day we shipped the first doses out of this site, it rushed over me like that was our moonshot.
Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN, Kalamazoo, Michigan.
A pretty emotional thing. Next, President Biden's dog, Major, in trouble again after biting another person. But so far, it seems he's staying at the White House. Major Biden is in trouble again. The first family's German Shepherd involved in a second biting incident. He bit a National Park Service employee on the South Lawn Monday, and the wound required medical treatment. Now, Major was sent home to Delaware after a first biting episode earlier this month, and he got training there, according to the White House. As of this morning, though, he hasn't been banished again. He's still at the White House, where he was spotted with the Biden's other dog, Champ, outside the diplomatic room and later outside on the South Lawn today. Major was leashed. Champ was not. Now, Major should consider himself lucky he has not been banished from the White House permanently after his second strike. Teddy Roosevelt's dog Pete was exiled, but it did take several biting incidents. The last straw for Pete was when he chased the French ambassador and tore off his pants. Well, maybe that is the standard for Major and why he is getting a third try. Ripping off someone's pants might be the final straw. All right. Thanks so much for joining us. Don't forget you can watch Out Front anytime, anywhere. Just go to CNN Go. AC360 starts now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.